And I think what happens that what takes place inside of here conditions people that so when they get out on probation or parole, they really think that my freedom is dependent upon me having a job. I have to work in order to be free. And so I think what's happening here is we're being conditioned for that low wage, take any job, whatever it is, I don't care how dangerous it is, how much it pays, take that job and keep it and work at it. Because guess what? If I don't, I'm going to end up, you know, back in prison.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Hi everyone, welcome to our conversation tonight on imprisoned labor and extraction. My name is Manali Agarwal, and I'll be introducing the conversation this evening. Our event tonight is entitled The Work in Us, a survey of imprisoned people on prison labor. Before we start, I would like to thank Haymarket Books for hosting this event with us and all of their work on the back end to make this event possible. Also, the Margaret Casey Foundation for sponsoring this event, and by doing so, supporting our future work on the project. I would also like to thank Study and Struggle for supporting the work in us since we started the project 2 years ago. And finally, thank you to our captioner and our ASL interpretation services this evening. Today, we're going to be tackling a very important and popular topic, which is prison labor. And we have a truly fantastic conversation tonight between Stevie Wilson and Ruth Wilson Gilmore. Over the past 2 years, a group of inside and outside organizers, including Stevie, have been collaborating on a survey of imprisoned people on the issue of prison labor. So much of what we currently know about prison labor comes from popular media and government statistics, which often distort the true nature of work behind bars, including how it functions, who it serves, why people do it, and what to do about it in the broader struggle to dismantle the prison industrial complex. As Stevie will discuss, his experiences and conversations with imprisoned people in Pennsylvania have led him to believe that prison labor operates really differently than how people outside understand and talk about it, and that it is critical to find ways through which imprisoned people can influence and be part of the organizing that is being done around the issue of prison labor. At a high level, a key takeaway from the survey so far has been the realization that there is so much nuance around the issue of work behind bars, and especially around how imprisoned people make sense of their labor. At the highest level, people's experiences and priorities are deeply influenced by things like geographical location, the type of facility that they're in, the length of the sentence that they have, and a variety of other factors. Some respondents to the survey agree with the popular notion that prison labor is forced. Other imprisoned people have told us that they actually choose to work and that they wouldn't have to if they didn't want to. When people tell us that they choose to work, they often cite clear and strategic reasons for doing so, while acknowledging that their labor also often keeps the prison running. These needs, priorities, and ideas of imprisoned people are not generally reflected in popular discourses on the issue of prison labor. I'm sure many of you have seen articles about imprisoned people fighting wildfires in California and Oregon, or others exposing the exploitative ways that prisoners are hired by corporations hungry for cheap labor. These stories aren't necessarily incorrect representations of some people's experiences, but they don't represent all imprisoned people's priorities, nor do they address the root of extraction, which we understand to be the prison itself. Similarly, recent grassroots and legislative efforts have focused on the exploitation of labor in prison, but less so on imprisonment as exploitation. In particular, there have been efforts to end the exception clause in the 13th Amendment, which permits slavery or involuntary servitude under the condition that an individual has been convicted of a crime. Proponents of this effort lobby state legislatures to eliminate this language because they argue it warrants prison slavery and strips incarcerated people of their dignity and humanity. But we question whether abolishing the exception clause alone, without abolishing prisons, can truly restore people of their dignity and humanity. For this reason, we position the survey to help us develop a broader understanding of prison labor within the struggle against the prison industrial complex. In this conversation, Stevie and Ruthie discuss the survey, highlighting some of what we've learned so far, as well as where we intend to go in our future work. The conversation that follows was pre-recorded, given the limitations and unpredictability of prison communication channels. If you'd like to contact us to learn more about the project or work with us in the future, please email us at theworkandus@gmail.com. Thank you, everyone, for being here. And with that, I'll pass it to Stevie and Ruthie.
How does incarceration impact and present people's ideas and understandings and attitude towards work, both here and, you know, upon release? And so, and work and organizing, how does it impact their ideas about organizing inside and on the street? Because it seems to be very hard to organize formally in prison people. They tend not to want to do that because they fear repercussions once again. Especially for employers who could call parole agents and saying they're being subordinate and things and get them reincarcerated. But what happens here is that the system promotes this idea that if you don't do this and don't do that and don't do this, you're not going to make parole. And in Pennsylvania, there are actually two different entities. So the parole board is not a part of the DOC. Okay, they're two completely different entities, and we're told that the DOC is holding us for the parole board. And so, but the DOC has to find a way to encourage us or, you know, coerce us into working. So one of the things they say is, well, if you don't have a job, the parole board won't let you go. Well, why don't you give everybody a job then? Why doesn't everyone have a job then? Why are only 35% of the people working? So that's been an issue for the longest time. I can tell you this much. I have never held a job. I have made parole without a job. Many other people, most people do because we don't have a job. So the parole board doesn't ask us about that. I saw the parole board last November, as people know, they didn't ask you about a job, okay? But we are told by staff here, oh, getting a job, you know, let's go for parole. If you don't have one, it doesn't look good. That's BS. But it's a way to also coerce you into taking a job or applying for a job. And if you do take the job in Pennsylvania and then you decide to quit, that opens you up to a misconduct report for refusing to work. But if you don't take the job from the beginning, they can't do anything about it. So that's like clarification in Pennsylvania. I don't know how it works other places. That's something we have to ask people about, the distinction between those two things. The other thing I was thinking about, I said, how does that impact people's ideas about work organizing also, okay? Like, and this is what we found, why it was so hard to organize people inside around labor, because they were afraid of the repercussion, losing my job and possibly not making parole if I joined that work stoppage or if I joined, you know, that strike or whatever. So that was something that we're gonna kind of dive into also a little deeper. These are type of things that around the country look different. Obviously, when you're looking up south, they don't pay people at all in five states. And so we're like, well, how did that play out around labor organizing? Which is probably why we see more of that type of organizing down south than we do in other places, where the people are being paid around meager wages, but they're being paid. And so that's one of the things. We're still having little problems also getting the actual number of people who are working, right? And what frustrates me is how people who are doing this work are talking about labor behind the walls, take the numbers from the DOC uncritically. Uncritically take the numbers from the DOC. And maybe, like, for instance, they, once again, referring to the ACLU, University of Chicago report, they said that Pennsylvania had over 33,000 incarcerated workers, which is not true. I like 40,000 people. What the DOC gave them was the number of people who work eligible. That's what they gave them.
Of course.
And not those who are actually working. So anyone who's not in the in solitary confinement, anyone who's not in, who has a medical condition or a medical allowance, you know, you take those people out, the next, the rest of us are actually the general labor pool. Over 33,000 people are eligible to work. How many of them are actually working? That's the number they didn't give them. So, and that report uncritically accepted that number without breaking it down and saying, well, what does that actually mean? Are all these people working? Do they have a job, everybody? You know, so it's really, really hard to get that number from the DOCs because they have an incentive to inflate the number of actual people working, to make it look like they're doing something productive, they're doing rehabilitation, you know, or giving them teaching a work ethic. So they have an incentive to inflate the number. And so we have to get people out there to stop accepting that number and saying, let's break it down. And one way you can figure it out is actually talking to people who are currently incarcerated. It says, is that what the sense that you get? You know, that 75% of the people at the prison are working? They're going to say, no, no. And so we have to get people, we wouldn't accept police numbers from the police uncritically. We're not going to accept their numbers uncritically, so don't accept the DOC's numbers uncritically. And that's something we have to get people to stop doing. The other thing would be is that we didn't think about how has COVID changed labor behind the walls. We know it changed labor out there, but there are people asking, how did it change labor behind the walls? And one of the things that I've noticed, and this is coming up everywhere, is that they are able to pull off, extract more labor, right, with fewer bodies now. Meaning here, like in Pennsylvania, when COVID struck, almost everybody lost, everyone was laid off for a little while, right, until they forgot how we're going to do this. Then they brought the kitchen workers back, they brought certain block workers back, and they did this, but they used fewer hands, fewer imprisoned people to get the same amount of labor done. And so once we got back to normal operation, they figured we don't have to hire that many people anymore. We'll just keep this same group of people that we have, fewer number of people working, but they're working the same. We have people now who are working 7 days a week, 16 hours a day, and they're being paid for 5 days a week at 6 hours. And this is typical now in the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. We have people who are working on the block, and they're working off the block, which is against the rules in Pennsylvania, but they have a block job and they're working somewhere on a maintenance crew at the same time. And so these people are volunteering their labor, all right, in order to stay out of their cells. Mm-hmm. You know, so we find that there are fewer jobs now in Pennsylvania, all right? They're actually being able to accomplish more labor, more work with fewer hands because people have 2 or 3 jobs. People are working every day. They're working multiple shifts. They're only being paid for one job. They're only being paid for 5 days. And so this has become the practice here everywhere. I saw it at Camp Hill. I see it at Dallas. This is what's going on. So with COVID, they were able to figure out a way to actually keep the same amount of labor, pay less people, you know, use less people. Mm-hmm. And so labor is not as important as it was pre-COVID. Having a job is not as important as it was pre-COVID. And so this is becoming an issue that all of us as imprisoned people are seeing it. You can't get a job. You know, they're saying they have no openings, but you have this guy working 2 jobs, even to get paid for one. Mm-hmm. So the prison is saving money. The little bit of pennies the little bit of pennies they were actually paying, they won't pay anymore because they got that one person on 3 jobs now. Mm-hmm. You know, I need to pay him for 1 job. So this is serious.
It seems this like it's serious. Also, if I'm following you correctly, that it's an additional convenience for the DOC and the guards to have fewer people to move in and out of the block and to and from jobs. And gives them greater control over those three people.
And what the control also is because now, right, the people who have those jobs will do anything to keep those jobs. You know, they see that there's a larger, you know, reserve labor pool that they can replace very easily now. I have a list of 30 people that want your job. Act like you don't want to listen to what I'm saying. Act like you don't want to do what I tell you to do. You know, so this is what's going on. So labor has become, you know, the DOC has found a way to do more with less people and paying less people will get the same amount of hours out of everyone. It's unpaid, it's truly unpaid labor now.
Right.
You know, you're working two jobs and I'm only getting paid for one. I'm not even getting all the hours I'm working for the job I'm getting paid for. And so something else has happened here. Once I came to camp, when I left Camp Hill and came to Dallas, I noticed when I got here that it was about programming. They actually have entire blocks here dedicated. Half the blocks here at Jehuthi are dedicated to programming. So they actually have about three blocks that are dedicated to alcohol and substance abuse programming. They have a veteran service unit. Okay. They have what's called a wellness block. You know, they have all these different blocks. And what they're doing is these are programs, and they're receiving money from the state, the federal government, and nonprofits to run these programs. And it's so amazing because, like the veteran service unit, it's not the staff themselves aren't doing the work. Once again, they have imprisoned people doing the work. I mean, as far as running the group and, you know, doing all the grunt work that's necessary to keep this program running. And they'll have a staff member they call the coordinator for the program. This person will come in like once a week, you know, and do the whole thing like he's doing something. All week long, it's imprisoned people doing the grunt work to keep the program running. So we think about the veteran service unit that they have. There are four of them in Pennsylvania. This is one of the prisons that actually has it. And so you have, you know, a block that has 150 to 200 people on the block who are supposed to be veterans. All right. Most of them are actually going to serve time in the military, different branches and things. And they go to this program. They are part of this program, and they're supposed to be connected with benefits and services for, you know, veterans. And so when they get out, if they're able to get out, then they're, you know, plugged in already. So these are things that actually should be happening in the community that should have happened before they even came to prison. But now the prison said, no, give us the money, we'll do it. Don't give it to the community service organization. Give it to us and we'll do it. So this is what's happening now. Now they have these bodies, people who should be getting these services in their community are having to come to prison. And the prison is providing the community service. It used to be a community service program. They're providing it, taking the money from the programs out there. And then the people are shot back out to their communities. We still don't have these community service programs. And so we find it with drugs and alcohol. We find it with the veteran services units. We find these things happening over and over again. And it's going to grow. It's going to continue to be that way, where you see mental health has been a big thing, another mental health programming here. So you're going to find that the prison is capturing the social wealth that should be spent inside the communities, right? And they're doing these programs inside the prisons. And so there's less money for community-based programs and services. And so we have to, and this is why I was thinking about the extraction part. You're taking the bodies out of these communities and you're bringing them in here and money is flowing through them. That should actually be going to their communities. It's flowing into the prison still. And couple that with the fact that the labor that's taking place for the most part is the labor of imprisoned people. They're still using imprisoned people. So we have these things called certified peer support, all right? And they pay these guys 51 cents an hour to do the jobs that used to be the jobs of the psychology department. So someone is going through a crisis in here in their cell. They're going through a crisis. They're having a problem. They need someone to talk to. They don't call psychology anymore. they call this peer, this other imprisoned person who is given 6 weeks of training, and they say, look, you go over and handle that now. And so now we don't have to pay somebody $60,000 or $70,000 a year. We'll pay you 51 cents an hour, and you work 2 hours, and that's what we do now, instead of having someone from psychology come over and do what used to be their job. So they're finding ways to cut corners, and it's on the backs of imprisoned people and that unpaid labor or meagerly compensated labor. But I just think that when I got here, I saw the extraction a lot more, because it was about just getting people in prison. And in Pennsylvania, Jefferson, Venango counties, and Warren County, these are rural white counties. In Pennsylvania, large rural white counties, sparsely populated, but they have some of the highest incarceration rates in Pennsylvania, higher than Philadelphia, four times higher than Philadelphia. Okay? Four times higher than Philadelphia because of the opioid epidemic, because of the unemployment there, because there's no jobs there, there's nothing there for them. So people are being captured from there and brought into prison. And then put into these drug programs here, instead of having them in their communities, right? They're being brought here, you know, and they're put into these mental health programs instead of having them in their communities, right? And so we find that more and more of these counties are, their populations are being brought in at rates that are astronomical. When I say Warren County, Jefferson County, Venango County, incarceration rate, four times that of Philadelphia. Four times out of Philadelphia, and it's running around drugs, and they're brought here and put into programs. Why can't we provide these programs, you know, in their community? You know, and so this is where I see it. I see it now.
And we can see it even in related areas, for example, in rural and also in poor urban communities, the very lack of health care on the ground for ordinary people, then suddenly emerges in prison and jail.
Yes, yes, yes.
But not in the free world.
And this is also why I'm starting to think that if we make this point, especially to people, community organizers, in these under-resourced communities, if we make these points, if we can make this connection and create some solidarity, saying, listen, you know, that money that should be, that social wealth that should be coming to you is going to prison. It's going inside the prison, and they're saying we're doing these programs inside. Well, why can't we have these programs outside? And so creating some solidarity between imprisoned folk, their advocates, and these community organizers who provide these services and programs, and saying, listen, you have a vested interest in starving the prison of these resources and getting them back to you. You know, and so when people in our communities can get these services and these programs there. So I was really thinking through that, like, how could we get, you know, these community service organizations, these community organizations that provide these programs, to realize you have a vested interest in seeing the prison shrunken and shut down. Because if you don't, more of the funds that should be going to you are going to go into the prison.
That was the entire basis for the prison moratorium project, first in New York and then in California. And it was to organize with people in communities who provided certain kinds of social services, or who noticed the drain of things like programs in schools, for example, of any kind, you know, arts, sports, and so forth.
Yeah.
And to get people to think about the relationship between the growth of prison and jails and the number of people locked up, and the starving of communities in cultural, health, and all other fields. And we, for example, held hearings all over the place to talk to people. They weren't like official state hearings. They were our own organization asking people to come and talk about these things. And it was really quite powerful. And about 20 years ago, for example, in Los Angeles, we did manage to stop Los Angeles from passing a referendum or initiative or a measure to raise money to build a new jail that was going to absorb more of these resources.
Yes, they are. Sure. So I think that's for one thing, that's one another step that I want to take as far as really making those connections and getting and doing it at those type of meetings, just sitting down with people and talking about, you know, we have a common interest in this and we see this happening and we really need to shift it. We need to stop the money going into the prisons and bring them back to the communities and understand that people shouldn't have to come to prison to get health care. They shouldn't have to come to prison, you know, to get help with substance abuse or drug abuse or anything, drug treatment, none of that. They shouldn't have to come to prison to get job training, you know, to get education. You shouldn't have to come to prison for those things, you know? And so I think that for me, looking at what's happening, that's a next step. And that's here in Pennsylvania, because once again, we're still trying, as far as like the survey, is to get a feel for what is happening on the ground in those places. We have some really good connections in Colorado and Utah. You know, Colorado is one of the first states to pass this, abolish the 13th Amendment. And, you know, and we talked to people there, and they were like, there has been no material changes whatsoever on the ground. People actually in Colorado, and Utah was amazing because they passed the same thing there. And they were like, we didn't know that even happened. They didn't even know it happened. There were people like, what are you talking about? So I think that, and this once again goes to the disconnect. When people, and I saw this once again and again, where people are doing this work, but you're not directly connected to people inside. You're not talking to them. And so that's what also makes this survey very different, because it's based upon what we're getting from people inside, the responses and the connections that we have with them. And to be able to say that we're in conversation with imprisoned people in 22, 23, 24 states, that's important. All right, to say that we're in conversation with them, we're building a network, and we're doing political education, you know, and they're really excited about that. And we're excited about that, because in the next round of questions, it's like getting a little deeper. What do we mean when you say you're forced to work? What does that actually mean? And how does that show up? And it shows up different ways, you know. And when we think about getting into people's attitudes about work, one of the things also I'm thinking about is we talk about people being desperate. People formerly incarcerated people are desperate to work. And what does that actually mean? It means they'll work for very little. Right? And why is that? Why is that? What happened inside? Because the prison shapes our attitude about work. And I think a lot of people should be going, we should be doing some more research about that, around what are the how are attitudes being shaped about labor? Okay, so people feel grateful at any job, really, no matter what you're doing or what you're being paid. You know, and you see it here. Going back to what I said at the beginning of this conversation, people are working 16 hours, 7 days a week, being paid for one job, one shift at six hours at 25 cents. And you're cool with that. Matter of fact, you think that's a good thing. How did that happen? What did the prison do to get you to that point? Because you wouldn't do that on the street. You wouldn't work 16 hours anywhere, getting paid for 6 hours, at such a meager wage, even if it was $15 an hour, you're not working, getting paid for 6 hours, and you're working 16 hours. So what did the prison do? Okay, and how does it actually work that upon us? How does it generate that attitude? And so I'm really interested in that. I'm interested in how prison shapes our attitudes about labor. And I think that's something we're going to definitely get into with the survey as we are talking to more people. We'll
you know,
talk
Steve,
about that.
You said something earlier that really caught my attention, and it was when you were talking earlier about people who are incarcerated imagining that their freedom depends on them having a particular relation to labor. And
exactly.
I think it's like really great that you're pursuing that line of analysis, because I think that in U.S. culture in general, people imagine that freedom and working are two sides of the same coin.
That's real also, not only inside, but think about when people get out of prison, right? So in order to stay out, I had to have a job. If I'm on parole or probation, I had to have a job in order to stay out. If I stop working, that's grounds for me, violation of my probation or parole, and I'm locked up again. Mm-hmm. Right. And so once out there, and I think what happens that what takes place inside of here, right, conditions people that so when they get out on probation or parole, right, they really think that my freedom is dependent upon me having a job. I have to work in order to be free. And so I think what's happening here is we're being conditioned for that low wage, take any job, whatever it is, you know, I don't care how dangerous it is, how much it pays, take that job and keep it and work at it. Because guess what? If I don't, I'm going to end up, you know, back in prison. Just like in here, if you don't take a job, parole won't let you out. So we're seeing it inside and outside where people are being conditioned to work. And once again, think that this has to do with freedom if you don't work. But it's real for people out there who are on probation and parole. And I'll tell you one thing I learned at Camp World also, there was an organization called SOAR. I don't know what this acronym stands for, but it's SOAR. It's an acronym. And they're actually what we consider like in New York, a body shop. Like in New York where they have these organizations that prey on informally incarcerated people or about to be, you know, released people. And what they do, the prison is giving them access to us. They come in, they do these type of presentations, and they get people who are about to be paroled to sign up with their agency, okay? And you sign a contract, and you go home, and you have to work for them, okay? And they basically send you on job assignments, and they get a portion of your wages. They get a portion of your wages. And if you actually don't work for them, right, they consider it a breach of your contract. And they try to get probation and parole to enforce it. Say, look, he signed this with us, and he's going to work for us. So even if you get another job that's paying more, you're forced to kind of go work for SOAR. And the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections is giving them access to people. And they're telling people, you have to come work for us because you signed this contract for us. But actually, what they're doing is they're getting money from the state, the city, you know, and they call themselves nonprofits and workers reentry. But what they're doing is they're preying on formerly incarcerated people and soon to be released people and forcing them to work for them at lower wages. And so that's another thing I saw happening. And I was like, going back to freedom. My freedom is contingent upon me working. And I feel like if I don't work for SOAR, I'm going to get locked up because I'm going to run a probation and parole and say, I'm violating. So I do see why people, especially outside, who are on probation or parole or under court supervision for whatever reason, even people who are not under court supervision, if you have child support, you have to pay. You got to go take a job. Because in like Delaware County, Pennsylvania, they lock you up for child support. They will lock you up, and it's $40 a day gets taken off whatever you owe for every day you stay incarcerated. You know, so this is what they do. Yes, in our country, people are being conditioned to believe that freedom is contingent upon working. And that's something that I love to explore once again. And Manali was someone who really brought that to our attention, actually. Manali was able to really bring that out with the analysis and what she had read through the work already. So I want to definitely credit Manali with that, not Stevie, Manali with that. But she brought that to my attention, you know. So that's another thing that we want to explore with the survey work. But it's been going really great.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Abolition for the People, The Movement for a Future Without Policing and Prisons, edited by Colin Kaepernick. Abolition for the People brings together 30 essays representing a diversity of voices, political prisoners, grassroots organizers, scholars, and relatives of those killed by the anti-Black terrorism of policing and prisons. Powered by courageous hope and imagination, Abolition for the People provides a blueprint and vision for creating an abolitionist future where communities can be safe, valued, and truly free. Another world is possible, Kaepernick writes, a world grounded in love, justice, and accountability, a world grounded in safety and good health, a world grounded in meeting the needs of the people. As Combahee River Collective co-founder Barbara Smith says of the collection, Kaepernick has assembled a community of visionary thinkers who unequivocally show that the path to freedom requires abolition. Find Abolition for the People at haymarketbooks.org.
So some of the things that we've already been talking about really caught my imagination. One of them is this entire political way that people conceptualize freedom as distinct from the 13thist way that all thought of freedom is somehow, you know, relegated to what happened in the middle of the 19th century, right? And that's one thing. The second thing related to that is the fact, you've heard me talk about this before, half of the people in the free world in the U.S. who are the age, you know, working age, between 16 and 64, have some disqualifying arrest or conviction. Which makes them documented not to work. Then there's a significant number, but a small percentage of the labor force who are not documented to work because of, you know, citizenship status.
Yeah.
We put them together, that's half of the labor force.
Yes.
All of the people in the labor force are encouraged or compelled to believe that capital F freedom and capital W work are two sides of a single coin. And I think that the work that you and our comrades are doing in this survey is opening up the width, breadth, and depth of these problems, which are not problems that will be solved, as you have pointed out many times, by a state legislature outlawing some kind of application of the 13th Amendment.
Okay.
There's something bigger here that is really affecting so many people's lives on both sides of the wall. On both sides of the wall. And I'm not saying that to say, therefore, it's the same on both sides. Of course not. But it's the continuity that you were describing earlier that matters so much. So I'd be very interested in how, you know, in the next round of the survey, people who participate in the survey might, you know, expand on and deepen how they share with us their understanding of freedom. So I'm not saying tell them what to think. I really want to know what people think.
Yes.
You know, because we can't organize anybody if we don't understand what people think. And you know, I was thinking when I was reading part of the report that on the inquest page, there was a discussion, a very long discussion by a person, I believe a woman incarcerated in Texas. I think their name is Jennifer or Jessica.
Jessica.
And Jessica was, you know, sort of describing things in relation to how we can, we might imagine plantation economies were during slavery and Jim Crow. And that might exactly be how relations are in Texas today. And it's also true that telling a story that way helps people make sense of a world that they're trying to figure out because they know other people will recognize the story.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Actually, I think that was Keisha. That was Keisha, that one.
Was it Keisha?
Yeah, that was Keisha.
Okay. Yeah, but those are like interesting questions to me. People will tell a story about their own life using a story they've learned to make sense of it, because that's how we tell stories, right? And so the extent to which we can kind of get underneath the skin of the story and see what the life is in it is really powerful to me for the purpose of organizing.
I'm really interested in like their question as far as how we can, we're getting information now that we're doing the political education, we're building the relationships and asking those questions and trying to get deeper questions, but where do we go as far as organizing? And I realize that has to be local, has to be hyper-local, whatever's happening there. And so that means taking the leadership from the people there, right there, what is most important to them right now. And once again, how they define these terms is freedom. You know, how do they define freedom? You know, how do they define community there? You know what I mean? And so that's important. How do they define justice? What does it look like to them? And so I think that one thing this survey has taught us is that any solution is going to have to be hyper-local. We have to get in touch with the people right there, because Keisha's in Texas. I think Jess is actually in the southwest part of the United States. And so it looks very different there. And so Jess has one solution. Keisha has another solution. Stevie has another solution. Our comrades in Utah and Colorado, they have different solutions. Washington has different solutions. So it's important to, once again, listen to those people, you know, and like I said, get underneath of that and then start asking deeper questions. And I think the next round, I know the next round in the survey, that's what we intend to do. And I think that we're going to eventually, because the thing is to bring all this information back to the people and say, now, what do you think we should do? You know, now that you see this information here, tell us what you think we should do. Instead of having a top-down solution, it has to be hyper-local and bottoms-up. And because that way the people become invested in it. So I'm really interested in where we go next, organizing, and how we can bring people from the outside into the work also, and make connections in this struggle. That's what I'm interested in.
Oh, me too. Yeah. Me too. And you already know, Stevie, nobody organizes because somebody has presented an abstract idea.
Exactly.
People organize because they feel something, they see something, they lack something, which connects to the abstract idea.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why this resonates, this actual project resonates with people inside, because work is, no matter if you're working or not working, right? And that's another thing, too. Remember that even though more than half the people in prison are not working, work is still a big part of our lives. It's still hanging over our heads all the time as imprisoned people. It really is. I haven't had a job, all right, and in the 14 years that I've been incarcerated, but it still hangs over my head. You know, work is still all around me. Work is something that is constantly being thrown at me, you know, and so even though I think, and that shaped my ideas of work also, and my attitude towards work also. So I think that we cannot, let's not forget the other, a larger segment of imprisoned population that isn't working and thinking about their ideas and understanding of labor and work too, you know. Mm-hmm. That's important.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, so,
well, you know, the people who are in prison, with a small number of exception, are all, as they say, in the prime of life.
Yes.
You know, people are between the ages of late teens and mid-60s. Those are the working years. I'm 73. I'm still working.
I think another thing, too, that was brought up, too, that we found out in the survey, listen, people want to work. People want to work. And that's, I've always, and people have their reasons for working. And I think a lot of times what was used to happen doesn't happen. This is something that the Free Alabama Movement was able to tap into and to change in their political organizing, was that they realized that you can't demonize people who are working. They have their reasons for working, you know, and at one point Free Alabama Movement said, it said, our weakest link became our strongest link. And what they meant was that they considered people who work as the weak link in what they were trying to do in their organizing. But then they realized, no, they aren't. They're actually the strongest link, those who are working, because they actually had the power to withhold their labor, okay? So they considered them the strongest link. I think one of the things that happened in the beginning of these talks with people around labor is they consider people who are working as like sellouts, you know, and the hardest to organize. And so they kind of dispose of them and cast them off, and not realizing that people actually have their reasons for working. And I can understand the reasons for working. Many people work because, even though it's meager wages, it's what they need to get the little bit of things they need in prison, because they don't have financial support coming in. So if the prison's going to give me $40 a month or $50 a month, I needed to buy hygiene products, I needed to buy food, I needed communication costs for my family, I'm going to do that. So we understand that. And I think approaching it that way right? Without the hostility, without you're a sellout. That actually changed the organizing in Alabama, and it made it more effective. And I think we need to remember that we do these type of organizing across the country, and not allow ourselves to dispose of people because they choose to work. Even if he's working 16 exactly. hours a day, 7 days a week, you know,
exactly.
he has a reason why. Yeah.
And you know, there's something else in there too that I think you were alluding to earlier, and that is that you know. All of us human beings are curious and creative people. And being able to be out and about and doing things is not, you know, can't all be displaced onto the wage, right?
Exactly.
That there are other things that actually lift people's spirit, confidence. And so to go back to the example that you just gave, about what turned out to be the strongest link, what people thought would be the weakest link,
exactly.
is in part, you know, tied to the fact not only that they could withhold labor, but because they have a sense of the entire complex that they are locked up in that's different from people who don't get to leave their cells, say.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And also they're able to connect with other people because they're out of their self. This is something that Ivan Kilgore mentions in his contribution to the symposium, that people were actually working because they gave them access to other people. And they were able to make connections and get out the cell and socialize. We're social beings. They want to be out and socialize with other people. So I think, yes, understanding the different reasons why people work. Right, and this is something coming through in the survey also. It's something that's coming through in the survey that we see. That's important. It's not always about wages. You know, people will work without getting paid, you know? So that's important.
I talked with some comrades from who had been locked up in Turkey for many years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They were a mix of, you know, political prisoners and people who had been convicted of not political things but have become political in prison. So you know what I'm talking about. And in the about 30 years ago, when Turkey was trying very hard again to join the European Union, the country was told, no, your prisons are out of date. They should be more like American prisons. They should be like the prisons in the U.S. with cells and people divided up. Yeah. And when the prisoners heard this, they said, oh, no, you're not going to ruin our community by dividing us up from these common areas where we live and work and cook for ourselves, the food that our relatives bring us. You're not going to do that. So that Turkey can be part of the EU. So they went on a hunger strike to oppose the, you know, USization of prison. So anyway, I met some people who were in the hunger strike who obviously didn't die and have since been released and actually then were expelled from Turkey. And it was interesting, again, to talk about all of the different ways that people make their way in the world that matters for what we're trying to figure out how to do in the context of mass incarceration in the United States. And there isn't like a single explanation whether slavery, you know, enslaved labor or private prisons or, you know, the one thing everybody thinks is going to fix everything.
Exactly. This is a complex problem. It's going to take a very complex solution. It's going to take a lot of people doing lots of different things. And there is no one-size-fits-all solution. And once again, that's what the work shows us. There is no one answer. There are answers, and there are solutions, but it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all. It's not what works one place doesn't work another place. The other thing that you mentioned about that with Turkey and how they fought back, but I want to say before we get cut off is that that's why I'm so against when people talk about these new prisons, building new prisons, because every time they build a new prison, right, they find another way to keep us more and more separate. They find another way to actually keep us away from each other. COVID did that also. We are now in a situation where what they instituted for COVID, as far as cohorts, now with normal operations, they're still doing it. So in the prison I'm in now, I'm actually in zone one. They divided the prison into four zones, and I don't get to interact with the other zones. You see, and that is a very rare thing that we, once a week or twice a week, I might see other people from other zones. This is what they did. And And so they turned the prison, one prison, into four. They cut it up like that. And this is what they're able to do now. So when I tell people, like, oh, well, these new prisons, they're more modern. I'm like, yeah, and that means they're going to be more isolated, more alienated, and separated from each other, so they can't build community. So let's not support those things. Let's always be against supporting new cages. Let's always be against that all the time. Because every time they have new cages, they find a new way to separate us and oppress us. And so that's very important. Very, very important. So, but I'm just really... really pleased with the work that's been happening and with the survey, and I'm really excited about the next stage. And I want to thank you for all your support. You know, the connections you actually been able to make for me to even work with people like Manali and Jacqueline, and we were able to bring some formerly incarcerated people in also. And so I look forward to the next phase and to enjoy your support, you know. It just, like I said, it's been brilliant. And I'm working with people who have been just amazing, you know. I want to see this network grow, especially the inside network. And I think it's actually what's happening now, I think, also is a prototype for what can happen with other projects. You know, about what people are talking about. We're talking about parole projects. We're talking about anything, you know, we're dealing with. We can say we can build networks across the nation behind the walls and talk to people on the ground and see what it looks like there. And then let's do something that's hyper-local and responsive to the people there. You know, and so I think what we're doing is setting the stage for this is how you do it. This is truly collaborative work here. Collaborative research, you know, between inside and outside, this is what it looks like. So I thank you, and I thank all my team members for what we've been able to accomplish so far, and look forward to this next year and see what we can do.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.